Okay, thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here. It's my first time in the on the West Coast. The weather yesterday was familiar to me, but it's better today, I'm glad. Okay, so I want to talk about some work we did at the beginning of this year with Burkhard Eaton and Lionel Mason. And I want to propose an object that we're calling the Corollohedron. And then there's going to be a lot of background material, which is based on work in a number of papers with the following people. Okay, so the basic idea, which is in some sense an obvious one and that we've been thinking about for a long time, is follows from the work of Nima Kani-Hamad and Jaroslav Trnka, who proposed a geometrical object called the amplitudehedron, which gives you amplitudes. Now, on the other hand, it's been known for a while that there are these objects called correlators, and in various limits, these correlators give you amplitudes, or at least the square of amplitudes. So this simple idea strongly suggests the existence of a bigger geometric object, namely the Corollohedron, which in various different limits should reduce to the amplitudehedron. And the correlator should give you the Corollohedron should be equivalent to the correlators. Okay, so this picture is summarized in the diagram at the bottom, and the plan of the talk will sort of be trying to flesh out the details of this diagram. So I'll be spending a lot of time, in fact most of the time, I'll be talking about this side. So I'll be explaining to you about correlators and amplitudes, so square of amplitudes, and I'll be writing them in the right space, basically. I'll be talking about them in a particular bosonized superspace, we call it, that will be appropriate for trying to understand the geometrical side. Okay, then I'll talk about the geometry, I'll talk about the amplitudehedron, the squared amplitudehedron, and the Corollohedron. Sorry, before I do that, I'll be looking at this particular limit of the correlator. This is the light-like limit, but written in this bosonized superspace, it's going to have a geometrical nature. It's going to be basically a freezing of a certain plane and a projection from that plane. And this limit is going to give me the square of the amplitude. On this side, I'm going to have some purely geometrical objects and generalization of polygons, essentially, in the way that the amplitudehedron does. But the same freezing and projection that I do over here, these are real objects. Well, everything's a real object, but these are real algebraic objects that we compute in some way. I do the same freeze and projection operator over here, and I get back this geometrical squared amplitudehedron. So that alone sort of motivates this Corollohedron as being the right sort of object. And then right at the end, I'll talk about how you actually obtain, how you map from the geometry to the to the amplitude itself, and we have a simple algorithm for doing that via cylindrical decomposition, and I'll discuss applications of that in the Corollohedron case. You'll notice there's a dot 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 there. It's not not as clear as this bottom case. Okay, so first superamplitudes. I'm kind of assuming I don't need to spend a long time motivating superamplitudes, or talking too much about this slide, indeed at all. So I'm talking about superamplitudes in plane n equals 4 Supiang mils, and I'm talking about the integrands of them, and I'll be using momentum supertwister space. So this is a twister z and a four components z, four components chi. Oh, thank you very much. case that these belong to C4/4. This is initially, I'll be talking about momentum supertwister space. So, as we all know, the structure of an endpoint superamplitude in n equals 4 super Young Mills can be summarized in this way. I have a loop expansion, where A is my coupling constant, and then I expand in my Grassmann odd variable, in this case chi's, and I collect together all the pieces that have the same Grassmann degree. They go like chi to the 4k because of SU4 invariance. I call this the n to the k MHV superamplitude. So here's this structure. And just to give you a very simple example, this is what the 5-point NMHV superamplitude looks like. These are twister brackets, in other words, determinants of four of a matrix made from four twisters. And I assume most of you have seen this before. Correlators in n equals 4. Well, there's a very brief motivation. Let me just say that they are the that in some sense the objects I'm looking at are equivalent to supergravity on ADS space. And in particular, there's been a lot of work in other fields on these particular correlation functions and other correlation functions, and so they have relevance for the integrability community and also the bootstrap community as well. So I want to emphasize that these things are interesting in their own right. They're interesting because of the information they give us about superamplitudes, but they're also interesting objects in their own right. Okay, so what do I mean by a correlator? I really mean correlation function integrand of chiral stress tensor multiplets in plane at n equals 4 super Young Mills. So I'm going to start this slide at the bottom here. This is a typical gauge invariant operator, which I'm considering. I just take two scalars in the theory and take the trace over them. So this operator, this is a canonical sort of thing I'm thinking of, but I'm looking at all things supersymmetrically related to that operator. In particular, the Lagrangian is supersymmetrically related to that operator. Actually, I am truncating the supersymmetry. I'm just looking at this chiral part of it. I don't have any theta bars here, so it's a chiral truncation of the stress tensor multiplet. Okay, so this is my operator. Now, the space I'm writing this in is going to be chiral superspace, which is not the space that we normally look at them in. We normally look at so-called analytic superspace. So in chiral superspace, this operator actually starts at theta to the 4, and the Lagrangian appears at theta to the 8. And there's various terms that you get with lower powers of theta, which are actually gauge dependent. So this is a very natural way of thinking about things in if you use twister Feynman diagram approaches. Okay, so this is the correlation function I'm looking at, and we find it has a very similar structure that we saw for the superamplitude. I expand in the coupling, and then it has this expansion in the odd variables. And finally, what are my coordinates? So I said I'm using chiral superspace, so that's Minkowski space and the thetas, x and the thetas. But it's very useful to think of this in super twister space. So it's actually a two-plane in super twister space. And to get back Minkowski space, I can... So this is a 2x4/4 matrix with a GL2 equivalence relation on the left. So I can use that GL2 to put the first 2x2 block to the identity. Second 2x2 block then is the usual Minkowski space in Weyl spinner notation, and the rest of the thetas. Alternatively, if thinking in more of a super twister way, this is two super twisters. This is a 2x4/4 matrix, so two rows, each of which is a 4/4 object, so two super twisters. And then it's just two super twisters, and they define for me a plane. The GL2 dependence says that the particular basis on the plane is not important. It's just the plane that is the important thing. So these are my variables. I'm going to call them x, I, alpha, and then this coordinate a. Although I will abuse notation later.
So a point in superspace is a super line in
superposition. Yes, exactly, yeah. Well, in projective, yeah, I use the terminology plane, but line, if you think of it projectively, yeah. Okay. Now, I mentioned this structure here, which looks like the amplitude structure. Now, the difference, which basically comes about because I'm starting at theta to the 4 here, is in the degree of the theta. This is of order theta to the 4 n plus k rather than theta to the 4 k. So it's a much higher power of superspace variables. And this feeds in later on when I bosonize it. So that's a sort of a complication, if you like. A simplification of what's going on here, very nice feature of it, is that the loop level correlators are given by tree level correlators. So I take a tree level correlator with n plus l points and k plus l Grassmann degree, integrate out all the additional thetas from n plus 1 up to n plus l, and that gives me the l loop integrand correlator. That's simply due to the fact that the Lagrangian sits in as multiplet, so I can view the loop integrand as a bigger correlator with Lagrangian insertions. Okay, so the correlators give the amplitudes in a certain limit, namely the light-like limit. So this duality can be written in the following way. I take the limit of the correlator, I call Gn, divided by, this is the normal way we view it, divided by the tree level correlator, and it gives me the amplitude squared. Both sides of this expression are full expansions, both in loop order and in thetas. The limit here is the so-called light-like limit, which in super twister space means that the lines that you just referred to have to intersect each other. In the bosonic bit, in the twister bit, they have to intersect each other. So I can choose to do that like this. The xi alpha, remember I had this alpha index. The first row can be zi minus 1, the second row can be zi. They're the intersection points, if you like. And then I can write the amplitude in terms of these z's. Okay, so this is what the duality states, but here it's the square of the amplitude, and both sides are expansions. So if I consider a particular term in the expansion on the left, namely gnkl, then it corresponds to the amplitude squared at that order, at l loops and at degree k, which becomes a sum of products of terms. Where I just take products of amplitudes, and the k's have to add up to k, and the l's have to add up to l. And this thing always starts with the sort of amplitude you're looking at twice, simply because one term here is when k2 is 0 and l2 is 0, and that gives me, and then this is nkl, and then I get the corresponding term from the other side, so that's why there's two of them. So it's 2a plus products of lower amplitudes. Note that this, there's a big story about the so-called maximally nilpotent case, where this k is equal to n minus 4, and then this would be an amplitude and this would be the barred amplitude. That's a special case of this, but the whole story is more general than that case. Okay, so this formula, in combination with this formula, tells me something very nice. So a single tree-level correlation function, let me consider this one, the tree level is this zero here, gives me the amplitude squared at that order. That's simply this equation. But the same correlator, gnk0, I can think of as a one-loop gn-1, k-1 correlator, and take the n-1 point light-like limit of that, and integrate out the remaining theta, and then that gives me a loop-level amplitude squared. and so on and so forth. The same tree level correlator can in fact give me k plus 1 different amplitudes, just by doing different operations, doing a full like-like limit or a subset, so just n minus 1 points like-like, n minus 2 points like-like, and so on and so forth. Yeah, sorry, this is all planar color order, yeah. And of course, the cyclicity comes about because this light-light limit, I'm doing a sequential, sorry, maybe I didn't say that, I'm doing a sequential light-light limit that is I didn't write that, but I'm sequentially making it light-like, so xi intersects with xi plus 1, intersects with xi plus 2, and then that imposes the cyclicity. To begin with, the correlation function itself is fully permutation invariant under the xi permutation, but when I perform the light-like limit, that gets reduced to the cyclicity. Yeah, I mean, it gets a bit, I think it gets a bit subtle because you're sort of identifying the chi's a little bit, but essentially that's right, yeah.
Also, like, when you say the loop and field is that just integrals?
Yeah, the integrand, yeah.
Yeah,
exactly. So you see, I mean, if you like, I could call it an integral and integrate over the corresponding x's as well. But I have to do the integral. It's not doing the integral for me. And then you've got all the problems with divergences and things anyway. Right. This is an integrand simply because I'm only integrating over the thetas, not over the x's as well.
And the integral, we know that it's not the unit defined because it can at some time miss or shift the momentum.
Okay. Well, in the planar situation, then as Numa's been pointing out for a while, that you can define a unique integrand by using these dual momenta and putting the x's sort of in the these region momenta where the x's sit in the middle of the loops.
Yeah, I mean, you can define what is the momentum uniquely, but the integrand can up to something equal to zero.
Well, all I can say is that for the correlation function, I can define my integrand to be this. I can really define this to be integrand, and then this gives you the same results that people obtain from BCFW. Okay, maybe that can be discussed later. So now I want to bosonize a superspace. So I want to go from super twister space, as Numa and Yara taught us, and Andrew Hodges before that. I want to introduce a global fermionic variable called phi. So this is back to the super amplitudes, and I go from my super twister space 4/4 to a 4 plus k object, a kind of extended twister, but purely bosonic now. So I do that by simply multiplying by the phi. So this is an A index and a Grassmann odd I index, that's 4/4, becomes a 4, now comma, because this is bosonic, and the index is A, which is related to how many different phi's I have. I have K, well, A index is runs from 1 to K, and the I from 1 to 4. Okay, so I map from the super twister space to this so-called bosonized super twister space, which depends on the amplitude you're looking at. It depends on this k. Okay, so this is what is done in the amplitudehedron. And then the simplest example that I gave you before simply turns into this formula. So here, everything becomes a 5 bracket. Although these 5 brackets are a little bit artificial, I write a 4 bracket as a 5 bracket and this y0, which is essentially projecting my 5 bracket to a 4 bracket. The numerator term here simply becomes this 5 bracket to the power 4. to go back from here to here, I simply integrate out all of the phis. Okay, so this alone, I think, is a very nice feature of this story, this new way of looking at nilpotent invariants. I'll discuss that in a minute. But let's do the same thing for the correlator now. So here my coordinates are two planes, I said, in 4/4 dimensions. So they belong to this Grassmannian of two planes in 4/4 dimensions. I introduce phis in exactly the same way, and I get a Grassmannian of two planes in 4 plus n plus k dimensions. Here I introduce n plus k phis, related to the fact that that's the Grassmann degree of the correlator. So the k here, the 4k variables here, is because my amplitude is degree 4k. Now my correlator is degree 4n plus k, so I introduce that many phis. And then the simplest example here is the sort of 5-point NMHV, to abuse notation, correlator. And it has this very simple form. Okay, so let me flesh this out a bit. So now, in this example, my space is 10-dimensional. It's 4 plus n plus k. 4 plus 5 plus 1 is 10. So I'm 10-dimensional. These x's are two twisters, if you like. They're sort of two objects each. So this is a 10 by 10 determinant, where the columns are the two, the x's are 2 by 10 matrix. And this is therefore a 10 by 10 matrix. So it's a very, very big, complicated object in some sense, but structurally this is very beautiful and simple, and you can see all, one thing you can see is this permutation symmetry very easily. And here I have a y0 which does exactly the same job as before. It simply projects this 10 bracket back to the four brackets that you get. This is basically xij squared, xi minus xj squared, written in this bosonized superspace language.
So why is it n plus k plane and 4 plus n plus k dimension?
Yes. Indeed, yeah. Okay, so going back to this 10 by 10 determinant, in the traditional analytic superspace, we have an analog of this. It's a complicated polynomial. And, we fought hard to try and understand the structure and the properties of that object. Here it takes this very conceptually simple form. Of course, the complication doesn't go away. It's a 10 by 10 determinant, but conceptually, it's a very simple object. Okay, I just want to do a quick slide telling you about what we know about correlation functions. So the one probably you've heard the most about is the 4-point correlation function. In this context, I write this as gnn minus 4, which is equivalent to g40. And then n minus 4 loops. And we now know this to n equals 14. The structure of it is as follows. It has this x1, x2 up to xn to the power of 4, and then I multiply it by a function of these guys. These, again, are just xij squares. Sums of momentum squared. Well, sorry, in the correlation function context, they're just xi minus xj squared. So it's a function of xi minus xj squared. A lot of the developments that enabled us to go to this high started with the observation of a hidden permutation symmetry, which was difficult initially for us to understand where it came from. Here it's completely obvious. The correlation function is permutation invariant. Here I have a prefactor, which is permutation invariant. Therefore, this function is permutation invariant. The correlation function is planar, yes.
But planar is not the permutation of the matrix, it's only
plus. Well, that's for an amplitude. This is for a correlation function. These are operators, trace. But in the large n limit. It's planar on a sphere. Actually, there's a nice story between how the amplitude squared. You have planarity on a sphere, and then when I take the light limit, I sort of, if you like, cut the sphere into two pieces. And then I have two things that are both planar on a circle, on a disk, which is the usual amplitude concept of planarity. Okay, so the only other correlator that is known explicitly that's not of this form is G6.1. So this is, if you like, thinking of amplitudes, this is the six-point next MHV amplitude. But it's a lot more complicated here. And so I want to give a flavor of how the this bosonized superspace helps you to understand some of the structure there in this complicated case. So we again fought quite hard to try and understand the nilpotent invariance of this order, G6.1, in analytic superspace. I won't go into the details, but eventually we found that they have this structure, where this is an object which is permutation symmetric under exchanging I alpha and J beta. And we found that it satisfied a very non-trivial identity, namely this one. Okay, so this is all, I haven't told you what this object is, but it's an object in analytic superspace, which we fought hard to understand. Let me see what it looks like in this bosonized superspace. So in bosonized superspace, I'm looking at G6.1. So the dimension of my space is n plus 4 plus k. In this case, it's 11 dimensional. Now I have six x's. Therefore, if I want to find an 11 bracket, I basically have to miss one super twister out. So let me label that by the guy that I miss out. I simply label this bracket by I alpha. Now the sorts of nilpotent invariants I have are always products of four brackets that don't have a Y zero, four genuine full brackets. So the most, so straight away, just from this simple argument, I see that the most general nilpotent invariant has this form, I alpha J beta gamma K L delta. You can see where this permutation symmetry comes from. It's completely manifest and obvious. And you can see this identity I gave you here as a simple consequence of a standard sort of Schouten-like identity that says that I can't anti-symmetrize 12 objects in 11 dimensions. This is just a generalized Schouten identity. Okay, so it really clarifies, I think, all of this this structure. This is what the correlator itself looks like. It's a bit of a complicated object, as you can see. So I only show this to display how complicated it is compared to, for example, the corresponding amplitude, the NMHV amplitude. Okay, I have to sum over S6 permutations here, so there's many, many terms here. Are you talking about the dual superconformal symmetry?
No, no.
The original one.
Ordinary.
Yeah, so that we don't have the analog of that here. That's the main.
Even dual. Is there an analog of the statement all superconformal amplitudes? I mean, all superconformal things realized on Zen and Negos are integral of the Grassmannian delta 4k slash 4k
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't really. The Grassmannian story is something we looked at on the way to here. But okay, no, it's a good question. I mean, here, at this level, though, I want to say that this sort of argument I gave you tells you how to construct these nilpotent superconformal invariants. I simply just write down these brackets. Yeah, no, that is a good question. It's a little bit of a We didn't do this very directly, to be honest. We saw the structure on the analytic superspace side, and then we... Okay, Now, the final thing I need to do before we go to the amplitudehedron itself is to understand a little bit about this y0 that I had. So far, I introduced it as an object which projects you back to the four-dimensional bosonic space. But given that you've got, everything's written as a bracket, an n plus k plus 4 bracket, so you have an apparent dl n plus k plus 4 symmetry, which is sort of broken by the fact that my y0 is fixed. So it's very natural to think of varying the y and having the full dl n plus k plus 4 invariance. So I want to now consider the same formulae that we have here, but think of y as just being some general y. It naturally lives, as you pointed out earlier, it naturally lives as an n plus k plane in n plus k plus 4 dimensions. And the second thing I want to do, so this is all still algebra, you know, I'm not doing anything geometrical here, in this, I'm just doing algebra and I'm doing some manipulations to it. I vary y and I also multiply by some volume form factor, the natural Grassmannian volume form, y d to the 4 yi. And that's what I want to call my correlator or my amplitude from now on. And now I want to ask the question, given a correlator written in this way, what is the meaning of the light-like limit in this Bose-Nice superspace? And it turns out that there's a very nice geometric-looking procedure for taking the light-like limit. I act directly on gnk. I don't need to divide by this gn00. And all I do is first of all, let's try and understand what the light limit meant before. It meant that xi dot xi plus 1 goes to 0. This plane and this plane intersect each other. Now it becomes xi, xi plus 1, y0 goes to 0, but I now promoted my y0 to a y. So it's this object goes to 0. And now it's useful to, instead of think of the x's as moving, to think of the y's as moving. So the y intersects the four planes created by these guys. So that's quite natural. The other thing I do is then, So I've now got a y plane in this big Grassmannian, this n plus k plus 4 Grassmannian. It's varying in many dimensions. And now I say that it needs to intersect n different four planes. So it's sort of intersecting here and then intersecting somewhere else and intersecting somewhere else. So it's gradually having less freedom to move. At the same time, I then project from these intersection points. So I need to do this because I want to go from a correlator to an amplitude. I want to go from n plus k plus 4 dimensions to k plus 4 dimensions. So I need to somehow reduce the dimension. And this is the way to do it. I project from all of the n intersection points. This second step comes about because I need to divide by 4n fermionic degrees of freedom. Okay, I can show you that explicitly in some examples, but I might, in view of the time, move on. So there I described in the maximal light-like limit. I can also do a non-maximal light-like limit where I do the same procedure for some smaller number of x's. And then I do an additional projection from the planes corresponding to the variables that I haven't done the light-like limit on. Okay, but it's a simple geometric procedure that one can implement. And the main reason I wanted to show you this correlator is to show you that if I do this procedure, you can really implement it. You can choose coordinates, do the freezing on those coordinates, do the projection on those coordinates, and you reduce this correlator to the corresponding amplitudes. Namely, the 6-point NMHV amplitude or the 5-point one-loop MHV amplitude. Okay, good. So that was all algebra, if you like. Let's talk about some geometry. So I think there's going to be a few talks about the amplitude hedron, so maybe I'll skip this a little bit, except I want to say that the original definition of the amplitude hedron, I see that there was a paper this morning which probably by these people which makes this part of the slide not true anymore, I guess. But this, at the moment, this is an implicit definition of the amplitude hedron. So I have a C matrix, a positive matrix in the Grassmannian K, N, and then I project that into the Grassmannian of K planes in 4 plus K dimensions. And this makes it difficult to get explicit results. So I hope we'll hear more about the new results where you have a much more explicit definition of the amplitude hedron. But I want to talk about the squared amplitude hedron, which is already a very explicit definition. And I simply look at the y's in the Grassmannian of k-planes, which satisfy this inequality. And because this is more explicit, it's easier to compute from. So that was for the tree level. There's a similar definition for the loop level, where I have a y-plane and several two-planes, and they satisfy various inequalities. And from there, we propose the corollohedron, which is, again, at y in this much, much bigger Grassmannian, satisfying these inequalities. So it lives in a very large dimension, but as you can see, it's very conceptually straightforward. It's a simple formula to write down. And now the point is, if I do exactly the same freezing and projection procedure, which I already saw worked on the actual correlators and the actual amplitudes, if I do that same procedure on the geometry, then, I can go through the details maybe later, but this thing that appears in the inequality here descends either to zero, if they look light-like related, or to this reduced four bracket, which is what appears in for example, there. So in other words, the same freeze and project procedure reduces the corollohedron to the squared amplitudehedron. Okay, and to finish off quickly, I've basically, on that original diagram, I've shown you the correlator to amplitude, corollohedron to amplitudehedron. How do I go across from the amplitudehedron to the amplitude? Okay, so for the amplitudehedron, the amplitude is the unique volume form with no divergences inside the geometry, and only log divergences on its boundary. Okay, so we, as part of this, we found a very straightforward algorithm to implement this via cylindrical decomposition. So cylindrical decomposition is something you all know about, sort of first or second year undergraduate. The question, how do I integrate over a region? If I want to integrate over a region, I want to write it as a multiple integral, and I need to write my region in terms of a union of sets of this sort of form. You know, first I integrate xn from a function of the other variables, and so on and so forth, and then the last integration has to be from a to b. Okay, so there's a command in Mathematica, cylindrical decomposition, which does this for you. I throw in a bunch of inequalities, and it throws out a union of sets of this form. Okay, so now instead of doing the integral, I simply associate with such an inequality that I get out. I simply associate it with a d log. Okay, so again, you can just do a replacement in Mathematica. This is very nice. You just throw in the inequalities, and out pops the answer. Remarkably, it's independent of the order in which you perform the cylindrical decomposition. Okay, so I have I'm running out of time. There's a quick example there with a triangle. So again, if I wanted to integrate over this triangle, I would first split the region. I would say my y goes from here to here, and my x goes from x1 to x3. So that's this term up to the dashed line, and then the next term like that. But now, instead of integrating, I simply replace the d log. So that term there becomes that up there, and it simplifies down to this form, which is when I covariantize it back. So here this is a triangle in R2, but if I think of it as lying in P2, I can covariantize it back, and it takes this form. Okay, so using this, we checked that the squared amplitude indeed gives over the amplitude in a number of cases. So there's an example. Maybe I'll look at the 5.1 loop NMHV case. So here I have external twisters in P4, and then I also have a loop variable and the Y as usual, and they have to satisfy these mutual inequalities. So just to show you what you do here, you just put coordinates on these. Put the coordinates on the loop guy and on the Y. Then insert these into the inequalities. That just gives me a bunch of inequalities in terms of the variables, A up to H. Do that procedure I just described, and out pops a differential form. And that differential form you can then covariantize and write like this. Now this is a big formula, but here the experts will recognize an NMHV 5-point tree amplitude, and these terms, there are 5 terms here which correspond to 5 massless boxes, which is exactly what you expect from this case. So this is the true level NMHV amplitude times the parity even part of the 5-point one loop amplitude. Okay, and we've checked a number of other cases. The direct corollahedron check is more subtle. So we've done we've looked at one case, namely this G51. There is evidence that this should not work in a naive way, and indeed we don't do it in a naive way here. There's also the problem. So this cylindrical decomposition I just advertised, it scales very badly with the number of variables, so it quickly becomes very slow. Here I have 24 variables naively, but I can use some additional local GL2 symmetries of each Xi to bring the problem down so that I only have 5 remaining variables. Then the inequalities, so use that as my coordinates, plug into the inequalities, do the cylindrical decomposition, this is what I get. If I now compare it with the known answer in the same coordinates, then this is what I get. And I deliberately write this d mu because I don't really know what the measure should become. But here we see that d mu is becoming a minus b squared, which in fact is completely natural, because what I did when I used these GL2 symmetries is I actually diagonalized a matrix here. And when you diagonalize matrices and write measures in terms of eigenvalues, then you indeed end up with an a minus b squared coming out. So that does look like a natural measure. But this is more of an indication that something is right in this line, but we don't fully understand the map from here to here. So just to summarize, I've shown you correlators, I've shown you how to take limits of correlators and give you amplitudes, but I've shown you how to do that in the right well, right meaning the right space for considering it geometrically. The same, then I have a geometrical region. When I do the same freeze and project, I get this squared Amperhesion. And I've showed in a number of examples that this squared Amperhesion corresponds to the squared amplitude. And so, the question is how to do this stuff at the top directly. So we need for more examples. We need to clarify the subtleties. I would like to understand how to get components directly from this bosonized superspace. Why do we need to go to superspace? I mean, this bosonized superspace, in some sense, contains all of the components. But the question is how to easily extract them. And then you can consider generalizations. And then finally, a slightly orthogonal direction that I'm interested in is obtaining amplitudes directly from the squared amplitude, but in this special case, the so-called maximally nilpotent case, where k equals n minus 4. This is the one that we know to very high loop order. Can we actually obtain amplitudes themselves from these? Okay, thank you.
Any questions for Paul?
So you mentioned that this cylindrical decomposition procedure very naturally gives you D-logs. What do you expect to happen in cases which are going to give you elliptic functions?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, here, I'm not meeting such things. So, no, it's an interesting question. I mean, this cylindrical decomposition works for linear constraints, so linear in each variable. And I don't know why. Maybe other people here do, but it's just an observation. It doesn't matter what order I do it in. It always gives the same answer, which is. But if you consider more general nonlinear things, then the naive implementation here doesn't give you the same answer. I do x first, then y. Do y first, then x. It gives me a different result.
Maybe first, just comment to that. So the amplitudes are D-logs. In these bosonized variables, all amplitudes. It's just when you go from these bosonized to the actual loop momenta, it becomes elliptic. Yeah, so here it will be always the log. But I have a question. So the problem with the first line is that you don't know how to define the form intrinsically on this on the Corellahedron, because it's not a logarithmic form anymore. It has these multiple poles, as you also.
Yeah, I mentioned
that. So is there
quickly.
Any progress on understanding
no,
that?
No, I'm afraid not. I mean, I'm intrigued by this because it's a double pole, but I should really think of it as a kind of, it's like an inequality. If I think of this, tau less than sigma, sigma less than nu, and then nu less than tau. Obviously it doesn't make sense, but it's almost wrapping around somehow. So that's what I'm trying to say here.
Because that was the connection between the amplitudehedron and amplitudes is that there is a form with logarithmic singularities on that geometry, and that gives you amplitude.
Yeah, no, I completely
so
understand.
You would like to have the similar.
Yeah, absolutely. No, what I've said here is that I have done that by, I think, essentially by cheating. I think I've sort of put the problem under the carpet here by doing this additional gauge symmetry.
Of course, you can kind of do circular definition, saying it's a form which in light-like limit would have logarithmic
similarities. No, but that's not what I'm doing here. Hey, yeah, I'm not taking any light-like limit or anything. I'm simply using more symmetry. So this really is the correlator in this example. It's a good question.
Another question. So. Is there any procedure for given the amplitude squared? Is there a systematic procedure? Any procedure for recognizing the different pieces in the amplitude?
That's not what you're doing.
No, but I'm wondering if from any other point of view. So indeed, as we'll hear about tomorrow, what defines the amplitude is the inequalities you talked about plus some topological conditions, winding number conditions that fix out different regions. It would be really interesting to understand what all the different regions mean, But if from a the point of view of the correlator or from any other point of view, there was some idea of how to take an expression that combines like MHV plus MHV bar and then to divide it up into the MHV piece plus the MHV bar piece, for example, even in the simplest case, that would be very, very interesting.
Well, I mean, we had something like that in the 4 and 5 point cases.
With Jake, we
did something like that in the 4 point case. We can extract 5 point amplitudes from the 4 point correlator, and there you can just look at the graphs, these F graphs, and look at their topology, and you can see whether it looks like. Well, as I was trying to describe earlier, you have spherical planarity. The light limit gives you like an equator. And then you can look at how many integration variables I have on the left and the right. That sort of tells me that it's a...
I can imagine from the correlator you could get the information. I was just wondering if there's if that gives you any intuition for something to look for in the amplitude squared directly.
Right.
Perhaps not. But
right. Yeah, I don't think I can answer the question right now.
Any questions? Oh, if not, let's ask thanks to Paul again.